The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Arie Nussbaum Cohen is a young, up-and-coming opera singer, and in 2017, when he was just 23 years old, he was one of six winners of the Metropolitan Opera's National Council Auditions, just one of his many prestigious awards he has earned. Arie Nussbaum Cohen is a countertenor. He's featured in the role of David on the 2020 live recording of George Frideric Handel's dramatic biblical oratorio Saul with Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra. Arie Nussbaum Cohen joins me to talk about his career. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So first things first, this is, you know, a pretty strange and difficult time in the world. Arts organizations like opera companies and orchestras and Broadway all shutting down indefinitely and lots of musicians really struggling. So how are you doing?
Yeah, it's certainly quite a unique time. Certainly the first time I've experienced something like this in my couple of years of career. But, you know, I'm hanging in there. I live in San Francisco, California. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, but I've been living in San Francisco for a few years and trying to just find the silver linings out here as much as possible. You know, we're fortunate. We've had a very low caseload in Northern California. So things aren't as crazy as they are elsewhere in the country. But, yeah, you know, just trying to work on roles that I have coming up in the future that'll be, you know, presumably after pandemic time. So you're trying to stay a little bit productive, but enjoying lots of hikes and walks and, you know, working on my pile of New Yorkers and, you know, doing what I can.
Yeah. You making sourdough? You're in San Francisco.
I did, actually. It's funny you ask, but of course, I had a sourdough starter going earlier on in the pandemic. I let it go eventually. It's just a little too much work. And frankly, store-bought bread, at least around here, is so much better than what I was making at home. So...
Okay, well, that's all good. Yeah. That's all good. So you're a countertenor, and I'd like to just have you start by explaining what that means. You know, what is the countertenor vocal range? How did you find your voice as a countertenor? And what are maybe some of the prominent roles usually sung by countertenors, particularly roles that, you know, people might recognize?
Yeah, absolutely. So countertenor, it's probably the most rare of all voice types in opera or in classical music. And we are essentially men who sing in the vocal range traditionally associated with a woman. But there's a very rich sort of tradition and history, and I think it's an interesting thing that in classical music it's seen as this kind of funky thing, but if you think about it in pop music, men singing in that sort of upper range in what's called falsetto, very prominent, very common. I mean, anyone from Prince to the Bee Gees to Sam Smith, it's very, very common. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly a lot of appreciation for that kind of singing in the general public and always continuing to grow in classical music as well. But I sort of had an atypical path to this career in general, but also to being a countertenor. Most countertenors are sort of training as baritones, as a sort of more conventional male voice, and then have a kind of aha moment where they realize, oh my gosh, I have this other voice that I could use. But I never had that. So I grew up, I started singing in choirs when I was in middle school, before my voice had dropped. And I was in this great children's choir in New York called the Brooklyn Youth Chorus. And we were doing all these amazing gigs. I mean, very frequently at Carnegie Hall and with the New York Philharmonic at Lincoln Center and all these places, and also all sorts of great pop gigs, singing behind Elton John at the Garden and behind Billy Joel and James Taylor and Sting. I mean, it was really quite a series of experiences for an 11, 12, 13-year-old to be having. And frankly, so the choir was what would be called a treble choir. So it's girls and boys. It's a children's choir, right? So it's girls and boys whose voices haven't dropped. Mm-hmm. Well, and when my voice dropped, I didn't want to leave the choir because we were doing all these amazing things. So I basically became a countertenor just from asking the choir if I could stay in and sort of finagling to keep singing the high notes that weren't as natural anymore. And well, here we are. I never thought it'd be a career from that decision, but, you know, I'm glad I stuck in the choir.
Wow, that is quite a path. My goodness. You mentioned, obviously when boys' voice drops, and just in general, singers, professional singers, your voices usually do mature and develop over time. Usually it's not your mid-20s that a singer sort of hits the sweet spot for your voice. So I'm curious to know how your voice is changing. How are you experiencing that?
Yeah, absolutely. As a countertenor, I think we have a sort of accelerated timeline compared to some other voice types. So our sort of peak vocally, I would say, is pretty much your 30s. Whereas if you are, let's say, a Wagnerian soprano singing Strauss and Wagner, it's not until you even hit 40 maybe that you start to really begin hitting your stride. So I'm fortunate that I've had some great opportunities to kind of get a career going at a younger age, kind of in advance of that peak. But it's certainly been a sort of constant process of discovery and working with my voice teacher and my coaches, and but I feel very grateful that my voice is just continuing to mature, and it's always sort of feeling better than it ever has before, and hopefully that continues over the coming years.
So you mentioned not having a traditional introduction to your singing career, but also I wrote on the street is you have a BA in history from Princeton.
It's true. It's my only degree.
And so that's pretty unusual right there as well. And I understand that you were sort of toying with a career in public policy. So you've really made a very different turn in your career. How'd that happen?
Yeah, so it all really happened at Princeton. So I sang in that wonderful choir growing up, and then I went off to high school, and I wanted to go to a performing arts high school in New York because why not? And I ended up at LaGuardia High School of the Performing Arts, which is the great, I mean, probably the most famous public high school for the arts in America, made famous in Fame, the movie and musical. And I had a really wonderful experience there, but still mostly just singing in choirs. I mean, that was really my focus. It was a great hobby that I was enjoying pursuing as a hobby. And so when it came time to go to college, I had no thought of a musical career, so I had no thought of going to conservatory or anything like that. So, I applied to quote unquote regular universities, and I ended up at Princeton, where I was originally a public policy major in the now renamed Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. And yeah, it was really there at Princeton that everything changed for me. I had, despite having all that great, despite having that great series of musical experiences growing up in the choir, I had never been to an opera. And I had never, I didn't grow up in a house with a lot of classical music. So aside from singing backup, singing in children's choir with the New York Philharmonic or other orchestras, there just wasn't a lot of that around. And it wasn't until Princeton that I went and saw my first opera. I won a free ticket from the music department at Princeton to go see an opera at the Met. And it was quite it was great fortune that the opera I happened to win for after entering this raffle that they have for a free ticket to an opera at the Met, I finally won at the end of my freshman year and probably my 10th try, and it was for La Boheme, which I knew nothing about opera, but of course it is the perfect first opera. It's probably the most famous opera of all time, and the Met's production of it is this beautiful grand spectacle that kind of shows opera at its sort of highest high. And I absolutely loved it. It just blew me away. And seeing just these kind of larger than life human emotions portrayed on stage, it just swept me away. And I just had this feeling that night that, oh my God, if I can do that for a living, like if I could do that every day, oh my God, I want to do that. And so, obviously, from there, it wasn't all a clear-cut path, but that was really where my kind of awakening to this art form began.
Wow, that's a beautiful story. It's real kismet.
Exactly. And
My
I'm
goodness.
forever indebted to the donor who donated back this subscription of Met tickets. Who could
Wow.
have known, right? But
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah. Oh, it's that's oh, it's gives me goosebumps. That's wonderful. So, music by George Frideric Handel. I was kind of looking at your, some of the things you've done, some of the roles that you have been singled out for doing. That really seems to be truly your specialty. So talk about your relationship with Handel's artistry, and if you want specifically the role of David in the Oratorio Saul.
Absolutely. I mean, I love singing Handel. It's the music that I think speaks to me in the deepest way personally. And the thing that I think is so remarkable about Handel, especially, but all Baroque composers, is we kind of generally look back, and a lot of people will say, oh, Handel, it's boring. It's not interesting. And the reality is, frankly, at that time, the musical palette that someone like Handel had to paint with was a lot more restricted than a composer today, just purely in terms of what they had, quote unquote, discovered musically, in terms of harmony and rhythm and just what they sort of thought thought was possible. And so to me, the really remarkable thing is to see just how much emotional depth Handel achieves with such a limited palette that he's painting with. And that to me is what makes it so special. But what I love about Handel is that later composers, like if we talk about La Bohème, for example, by Puccini, which is, you know, still to this day my favorite opera of all time, and many people's, Puccini knew exactly what he wanted, and Puccini wrote in his score, in his manuscript, everything that he wanted. I mean, every dynamic, every time he wanted you to increase in volume, decrease in volume, accent a note, etc. It's all really right there. So, you know, you have a guide you really have to follow. But what I love about Handel is that Handel was writing these operas really quickly. He was a businessman running an opera house in London and just trying to create new works for this house that would sell well. And so he was writing really quickly and almost like kind of whimsically. And as a result, there's what we get from Handel in the score is there's beautiful music there, of course, but there's a lot less specificity in terms of, you know, really specific dynamics or things that Handel wanted you to do. So it's up to you as the performer to bring out what you want to bring out, what's meaningful to you, and to paint with your own palette, right? And to combine that with the palette that Handel was painting with. And to me, that's what makes it so special to sing. I just feel like I have so much freedom when I'm singing Handel to make artistic choices that are meaningful to me in a way that I think vibes kind of well with Handel's scores, but that, you know, it's just lovely to me to have that freedom. So I really love singing Handel, and I have to say David in Handel's Saul is my absolute favorite role I've performed to date, not just by Handel, but really by anyone. And, you know, I was talking about that kind of limited palette that Handel was painting with, and that's what makes, to me, a piece like Saul so extraordinary, is that it is such a dramatic, kind of vibrant story and piece and music. And the fact that Handel was able to achieve that while painting with such a limited palette, to me, is really extraordinary. I mean, the image that we get of this King Saul descending into madness in this almost kind of King Lear-like portrayal, combined with this rise and very multifaceted portrait we get of the future King David, it's a really vibrant portrayal of these characters in a way that I think is amazing, given the limited palette he had to paint with.
Yeah. Do you have a particular favorite aria or a particular favorite section from the oratorio?
Yeah, I would say my favorite aria is probably in the first act, end of the first act, O Lord, whose mercy's numberless. And what I love about the character of David is that as a performer, I really get to show off everything and just explore everything in this kind of really wide character arc where we see David as this future king who's really aggressive on the battlefield, and we get some music that really portrays that side of him. But what we see more than anything else is this incredible tenderness and this incredible, just this tenderness is really the right word, I think. He's a really insightful kind of man, and we see a very interesting portrayal of homosexuality between him and the king's son, Jonathan, which biblical scholars agree is pretty much there. Anyway, so it's a really fascinating character, and this aria, O Lord, and at the end of the first act is the first time we really get to see David at the height of his powers. Mm-hmm. David, historically, it's in the Bible, was a shepherd boy who was kind of plucked from the field to be the future king of Israel. But the reason that he kind of made his way into the court and grew in prominence was due to the beauty of his singing and his playing of the lyre, of the harp. And so this aria, O Lord, is the first time we really see that. The King Saul has just had his first sort of fit of madness and rage that we see in the piece. And the king's children, his daughters, really call David in to come soothe the king's tortured soul. And David sings this beautiful kind of three and a half minute, really just tender kind of prayer, O Lord, whose mercy's numberless, kind of praying that the King Saul's madness will be calmed.
Mm. I can't wait to hear that. So this is quite a cast of musicians that you have made this recording with. Would you like to talk a little bit about your colleagues on this recording?
Absolutely. It's a really wonderful cast, and we had such a wonderful time on a personal as well as professional level recording this and doing these performances together. And to me, it really makes all the difference because it's interesting, as classical singers, we're freelancers, right? So we're not attached to one company usually, and we're going around and meeting a new group of people and making art with them, and then 10 days later moving on to the next one. And so there are certain times that you really kind of come together as a unit in a really special way, and there are some times where, you know, you do the sort of job together and you do your best, but it doesn't click in that same way. Mm-hmm. And this was one of those really special times where we all just clicked. An amazing cast, but I think even sort of most extraordinarily, just the orchestra and chorale and the conductor, Nick McGeegan, truly an extraordinary group of people. And it was a real thrill for me to be performing with them at all, let alone in a role like this, because it was their recordings that I really grew up on musically when I was first falling in love with this music in high school and then really in college. It was Philharmonia Baroque's recordings of Handel that I was burning out on my Walkman as I kind of played the CDs over and over.
Wow.
And to think that I'm now on one of those recordings with them, I still have to pinch myself. And, and to think that maybe some future countertenor might pick up, you know, or future countertenor whoever might pick up, you know, this recording, it's very special to me.
That is special. It's kind of a Cinderella story. Amazing.
Exactly.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So what other upcoming projects are you looking forward to once we get past all this?
Ooh,
what you got on the docket?
I know. Well, the question is when we get past all this. Right now, I'm pretty much canceled up and through next spring, and I've already lost some engagements that are like next April. And so I'm just really hoping that, you know, I'm holding on to the hope, obviously, that whenever we are able to return to that kind of in-person music making here in the U.S., you know, I'm just really looking forward to that day. And I'm also just looking forward to other roles I have coming down the pike, some other great Handel heroes that I'm working on, and also a lot of great contemporary masterworks that I'm preparing right now, some really challenging but exciting pieces. So, just trying to sort of keep my head down and be productive working on those roles, even with a lot of uncertainty in the air right now.
Great. Good for you. Well, I've been chatting with countertenor Arye Nussbaum-Cohen about his career in music and his participation in Philharmonia Baroque's recording of Handel's Oratorio Saul. Thank you very, very much for speaking with me, and you stay safe.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, and stay healthy, everyone.